Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, November 2, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Praxis Group's telephone conference call. Today we discuss felon voting and the case in Virginia in particular. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we are recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome our expert, Michael Kirk. He's a partner at Cooper and Kirk Law Firm right here in Washington, D.C. They represent one side in this case. I'll let him explain their representation, but that he'll give us opening remarks of 8 to 12 minutes. But as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of those questions for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Michael Kirk, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, and good afternoon, everyone. As Dean mentioned, I thought we would begin with a short description of what took place in the challenge to Governor McAuliffe's use of his clemency powers to try to evade the Virginia state constitutional prohibition against felon voting, and then maybe discuss a couple of ways in which the case has broader implications outside of Virginia, and then open it up for questions. The case in Virginia really concerned the intersection between two state constitutional provisions, one of which provides Article 2, Section 1, that no person who has been convicted of a felony shall be qualified to vote unless his civil rights have been restored by the governor. And the second provision, Article 5, Section 12, as part of the clemency powers granted to the governor, authorizes the governor to, quote, remove political disabilities consequent upon conviction. The case really was brought about when, on April 22nd of this year, Governor Terry McAuliffe issued an executive order that purported to restore voting rights to every felon who had finished his or her prison sentence and their supervised release or parole period. That was over 206,000 individuals that he purported to restore voting eligibility for. We were retained by the Speaker of the Virginia House and the Majority Leader of the State Senate, Speaker William Howell and Senator Tommy Norment, and four other voters to try to challenge this action. And we brought an original mandamus action in the Virginia Supreme Court, advancing the argument that Governor McAuliffe's unprecedented use of the clemency power effectively amended the felon voting provision out of the Virginia Constitution by allowing all convicted felons to vote once their sentences had been completed. Not one of the 71 previous governors, going back to Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson, and most recently Tim Kaine and Bob McDonnell, had ever exercised their clemency power en masse. In fact, Governor Kaine, at the end of his term, actually considered taking a similar action at the request of the ACLU, but he concluded that the Constitution did not grant him that power. And finally, we relied very heavily on the Virginia Constitution's anti-suspension provision, which prohibits all power of suspending the laws without the consent of the people's representatives. Now, the history of this provision is highly illuminating. It was included in Virginia's Bill of Rights in its original 1776 Constitution, which was drafted by Thomas Jefferson, and it was modeled after a similar provision in the 1689 English Bill of Rights, which was adopted in response to the Stuart King's abuses. And in particular, the anti-suspension clause in the 1689 English Bill of Rights was adopted in response to King James II's 1687 Declaration of Indulgences, which had suspended English ecclesiastical laws and provided mass clemency to for all earlier convictions for violation of those laws. In other words, King James II had abused his clemency power in an effort to effectively repeal the laws that he disliked, just as Governor McAuliffe did over 300 years later. Fortunately, the Virginia Supreme Court held that the governor's clemency powers may not be deployed en masse to suspend the constitutional felon disenfranchisement provision. And the court issued a writ of mandamus declaring that the executive order that Governor McAuliffe had issued was invalid, and ordering the McAuliffe administration to take all felons who had been registered pursuant to that invalid order off the rolls. And so that's in a nutshell a summary of what took place in the case. And I thought I would briefly touch on two aspects of the Virginia Supreme Court's ruling that I think may have broader implications beyond Virginia. And the first that was quite interesting was the court's standing ruling. We were very surprised at the relative dearth of case law addressing whether dilution of the value of a vote resulting from an allegedly unlawful expansion of the electorate constitutes cognizable injury that would support standing. Almost all dilution cases that we have found, the vast majority of them, arise in the one man, one vote context, where the injury being claimed is comparative. That is, the voter in County A is saying that his vote is worth less than voters in County B due to malapportionment, that sort of injury. In this context, the injury suffered by every Virginia voter, including our six clients, was identical to the injury that is suffered by every other voter in the state. The power of his or her vote was reduced to the extent that ineligible felons were, convicted felons were permitted to vote by the executive order. So the state argued in responding to our petition that we lacked standing to bring it based on, you know, general cases that bar general grievance type standing. And it was a close call. The court went 4-3 on this, but and obviously in our view correctly held that any time the absolute value of a vote has been diluted, that voter has been injured, and, you know, assuming the other requirements of standing are met, that voter can bring suit to challenge that exemption. And I think this may have implication in other jurisdictions. It's not hard to imagine situations where the incumbent party, the party controlling the state government, takes action to expand the electorate in a manner that favors that party, and voters who feel differently now have precedent supporting the proposition that they may challenge such action, because any voter who is absolutely deluded by such an expansion has standing. The second aspect of the case that has, I think, broader implications to the extent that challenges to felon disenfranchisement provisions are brought in other cases is an argument that wasn't really directly made by the governor, but was made as sort of an atmospheric, and that's the assertion that felon disenfranchisement provisions are racially discriminatory. The governor, you know, both publicly and in his briefs, argued this up one side and down the other, even though it really didn't bear on the legal issues before the court. And because it's such an incendiary charge, we naturally felt compelled to respond to it. And it reminded me of another case we did maybe 10 years ago on behalf of then Governor Bush in Florida, in which we defended a challenge to Florida's felon disenfranchisement provision, which was a direct equal protection challenge. And the answers to this challenge that I think are almost always going to be the case is, number one, the 14th Amendment itself, the text of the 14th Amendment, actually contemplates the possibility that states might choose not to grant the right to vote to persons convicted of felonies. And number two, it's almost always the case, and it was the case in Virginia, and it is the case in Florida as well, that the felon disenfranchisement provisions predate the Civil War. And in the case of former Confederate states like Virginia and Florida, that fact makes it, you know, logically impossible that those provisions could have been enacted out of racially discriminatory intent, because at the time they were enacted, due to, you know, the shameful pre-Civil War slavery regime that also disenfranchised all African Americans, the purpose behind the felon disenfranchisement provision was simply the judgment that persons who had been convicted of felonies should not be permitted to vote. And so that's a point that I think has broader implications beyond the Virginia case and extends to really any challenge to a felon disenfranchisement provision. And with that, Dean, let me pause and suggest maybe now would be a good time to open the floor for questions.
Terrific. Well, thank you for that briefing. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, just push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me make a quick announcement about our upcoming schedule. Tomorrow at noon Eastern Time at this same number, we'll be talking about State Farm versus U.S. Rigsby. That concerns whether a claim made under the False Claims Act should be dismissed when the complaining party violates a seal requirement and discloses the complaint. That's tomorrow at noon. Friday, we'll be talking about voting in Guam. The question there is whether or not you must be a Guam native to vote in a referendum that's happening there in Guam. Today, of course, we're talking about felon voting. If you have a question, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask the first question to get things started here. What's happened since your victory? I've read, I'm a resident of Virginia, and I've read, I guess, that there's been, I don't know if you would call it less than precise compliance or if somebody's found a loophole, but there was, the last I heard, the use of a signature pen to start doing these commutations individually, but sort of en masse just the same. Can you fill us in on what's transpired since the court ruling?
Yes, and that's been sort of a mixed result. After the Virginia Supreme Court issued the writ of mandamus, the administration did comply with the order to remove all of the felons who had been registered pursuant to the April 22nd executive order. But then the governor announced that he would be signing large numbers of individual commutations, starting with the individuals who had attempted to register under his invalid order. And I think he issued, I don't recall the exact number, but it may have been as many as, you know, 6,000 or 7,000 or 8,000 of them for that purpose. At that point, we did attempt to go back to the Virginia Supreme Court on the theory that what he was doing was contemptuous, and we sought an order to show cause, but the court denied that. So he's essentially gone forward on the basis that he's issuing them individually, and he is issuing, you know, fairly large numbers of them, but the courts apparently concluded that that does not violate their orders because they declined to issue the order to show cause.
Now, issuing them individually, I mean, I'm envisioning just a signature machine literally signing one after another after another. Is that the case, or do we know, or is the government saying there is sort of some level of individual review of each case a determination that this one qualifies, and therefore
yeah,
there's
Dean,
no competition.
It's certainly very opaque. Let me preface everything by that. The Governor McAuliffe's administration has been pretty stingy with the details, but they do claim that there is some kind of individual review process that goes on, and that the, you know, before the paper is presented to the governor, and while that there's some review that is done to ensure that the person meets his criteria for, you know, why he feels that the person should be restored. And while the governor had made comments about using the signing machine, I think those were made in a political context in conjunction with the Democratic convention, and their subsequent announcements did not indicate that they were doing that. I think he may be signing them individually, but there's certainly a lot of mystery associated with this process.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Maybe you can tell us about what interaction there is, what's happening in other states with regard to felon voting, and what, if any, is the interaction with this and voter ID requirements and other, you know, ballot integrity measures?
I think this issue is taken... It has not been on the front burner in the last couple of years until Governor McAuliffe tried what he tried in Virginia, at least from a litigation perspective. There has been, I think, a fairly steady campaign led, I think, primarily by the Brennan Center in New York to try to convince legislators to the extent that felon disenfranchisement provisions are statutory, to try to convince the legislatures to amend them. And there's sort of a wide variety of state laws on the subject. There are relatively few states that are as complete as Virginia is currently. I think it's four or five of them. Most other states tend to draw the line at, you know, fairly serious felons, and there are some that don't disenfranchise any, even I think one or two, and it's, I think they're New England states, that actually permit felons to vote while they're still in prison. So that's kind of the state of play. In terms of the interaction with the voter ID laws, the primary overlap, I think, is the argument that's often raised in challenges to both, that they're motivated by racially discriminatory motives. And those are almost always arguments that are grounded entirely on disparate impact type statistics, and almost always there's not really any evidence that the motivation behind the law is racial discrimination. I suspect if it were a more accepted legal argument, the challengers would get a lot more traction arguing that the laws are motivated by partisan considerations. But because, you know, partisanship isn't really we'll see with the case up at the Supreme Court this term, isn't really a basis for challenging election governing laws, that argument isn't made very often, and instead they fall back to the racial discrimination argument.
We do have one caller with a question. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, gentlemen. This is Roger Candelaria. Thank you for a really interesting presentation. My first question is sort of historical. As I remember in law school, we were taught that there were either 7 or 9 common law felonies. How many felonies are there today?
I don't know the answer to that, but I'm quite certain it's many, many more than 7 or 9. Just in terms of statistics I've seen, the probably the bulk of the or the largest number of felonies, both in Virginia and nationwide, I think, are drug-related, which of course wouldn't have been any of the common law felonies from you know back in the day. And you know, there's certainly policy arguments for suggesting that we've gone overboard in terms of criminalization, and I know that there's been a movement that's been surprisingly bipartisan in the Congress to try to cut back on the number of things that we're criminalizing, and I think there's a lot of merit in that.
May I follow up?
Sure.
The reason that I asked the question is because those original felonies all seemed to me to be sort of antisocial behavior that worked against the well-being of the community, and in that kind of case, it would seem to make sense that those who didn't regard the community highly ought not participate in the decision making for the community by voting. But with a number of felonies now and the overcriminalization to which you refer, that rationale, is it weakened?
I think it might be. I certainly don't hold myself out as an expert on the policy behind felon disenfranchisement provisions. I think you've accurately identified what the original, and really still I think the rationale to the extent states maintain disenfranchisement, and that is that by, you know, committing a felony, an individual has basically decided not to take them outside the, you know, the social polity, and for that reason it's fair for the community to exclude them from, you know, self-governance. The point that you make about the, you know, huge expansion of you know, criminal things that are felonies, I think probably does cut into that rationale. Now, some states try to address that by limiting disenfranchisement to particular crimes, and you know, almost always the primary limitation will be to violent crimes, which I think kind of takes it back to that original policy behind the felon disenfranchisement laws.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Let me ask you, we mentioned here the overcriminalization. That I think, is a phenomenon that I've identified mostly with the federal government, or I hear talked about mostly with regard to the increasing number of federal crimes. So are these people that served in Virginia, the 2006 that that are at issue here, were they guilty of state felonies, federal felonies, some mixture thereof? How much, and what other roles are there for the federal government beyond perhaps defining a felony for some of these cases?
The 206,000 were people who had committed either state or federal felonies.
Mm-hmm.
Either okay. One was, you know, is disqualifying. And you know, in terms of I do not hold myself out as a policy expert on overcriminalization. I do have the sense that, you know, like you, Dean, that it has become a problem on the federal level. I have a less sense, but still somewhat, that it's maybe a lesser problem, but still a problem at the state level. And again, I think it's primarily in the area of illegal drugs. There's you know, a fairly large, you know, group. I think the number I saw was, you know, 60% of the 206,000 people had committed nonviolent felonies. Now that left 40%, you know, so still, you know, tens and tens of thousands who had, you know, committed some kind of violent felony, from, you know, murder to rape to, you know, violent assaults. But I think there is, I think a lot of people do have sympathy for the idea that, you know, for example, somebody who is convicted of, you know, possession of marijuana, and assuming that that could be a felony, that perhaps it's not such a bad idea to allow that person to vote. And a lot of that gets stirred into the conversation, both in terms of what the policy ought to be, and then also what criteria chief executives should apply when they choose to restore rights to, using their clemency power.
Yeah, I was going to suggest that might be the perfect case for the exercise of an individual clemency.
Exactly.
Interesting. We do have two more callers with questions, so let's now take another call.
Fred Young is my name. I have two questions. One, is there any active political opposition to Governor McAuliffe's recent behavior? And the second is, are you aware of any data on the political proclivities of felons? Do they tend to vote Democratic? Do they tend to vote Republican?
Let me answer the second question first. I do not have a good feel for that. There's, as far as I know, I'm not aware of data that describes, you know, which way convicted felons tend to vote. It is very clear to me that Governor McAuliffe and his administration felt that they would be positive for the Democrats. If you look at sort of the way they approached this matter, it was his actions were politically timed in order to maximize the ability of Democratic voter registration groups to sign people up,
sure,
while minimizing the time period for legal challenges. By he signed his executive order in April and had pre-positioned, you know, various, you know, ACORN-like groups to immediately begin canvassing in different areas where there, I guess there were larger numbers of convicted felons, to try to register them. That was no accident, because he wanted to give them sufficient time to, you know, recruit and register additional voters that they thought would support the Democratic ticket, while at the same time minimizing the time for a court to step in and stop it. And I'm sorry, sir, I have forgotten your first question. Would you mind repeating that?
Is there any active political opposition to his current behavior?
Yes, there was, very active. Our clients were the leadership in the General Assembly on behalf of the, you know, Republican opposition. One other thing that this has sparked is renewed interest in potentially amending the constitutional provision, and this goes back to the overcriminalization point that was discussed earlier. I think Senator Normand announced after the Supreme Court decision that he would propose an amendment that would, number one, I think, limit the governor's ability to use his clemency powers to address felons who've been disenfranchised, but at the same time to reduce the sweep of the provision to, I think, violent felons. That has generated, you know, the governor and the Democrats immediately said that they thought that was outrageous and they opposed it. Within the Republican caucus, my understanding is there's sort of a range of different views on how and whether the Constitution ought to be amended, but it's definitely generated political pushback, and I don't know if anything will get passed, but I know this will be on the agenda when the General Assembly comes back in January.
As a practical matter, at the rate that he is generating these documents, is he going to be able to achieve 100% of the 230,000 that he had tried to legitimize?
I think he has a shot at it.
Doesn't have much time.
Yeah, because, you know, the process for amending the Constitution is two session process. If I recall correctly, they have to pass it twice, and then it has to go to the voters.
That wasn't the issue I was raising.
Does he have enough time left in his term?
No, before the election.
No, his clock has already run out on that. No, there's no chance he could have done that. In order to vote in Virginia, I believe you have to be registered by, I want to say, October 24th. Whatever the date is, it's already passed. And
You don't have same-day registration, I take it?
We do not, no.
Yeah.
He had no chance of that. And even if he had managed to sign them all, there's no way he could have gotten them all registered. So I think once the Supreme Court ruled against him, his political priority became trying to salvage as many as possible of the ones who had registered pursuant to his illegal order. And that, you know, was no easy task for him because he, number one, had to sign their individual clemency orders, but then number two, they had to get them to re-register because the court had ordered them to take them off the rolls. And I don't have a good sense as to
Democratic, since the Democrat machine was all set up to prosecute, and I doubt that there was a Republican group parallel to that. So
that's basically right. That's basically right.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending, so let's now take another call.
This is Tristan Daedalus. Thanks for taking my call. Are there tiers of rights restoration on the individual clemency grants currently? And I guess, namely, I know there's a number of other rights, such as concealed carry, gun possession generally. Does a violent offender also receive all of those back with the clemency grants that are currently being promulgated?
The governor purported to not grant back. Let me divide the question into two categories: gun rights and other political rights or civil rights. The only other major political right that was restored when he restored political rights was the right to sit on juries, and that actually generated, while his order was outstanding, additional litigation because there is a very high-profile case involving someone who killed a Virginia state trooper who was, you know, being prosecuted for murder, and I believe that it was a capital prosecution. And his lawyer immediately filed a motion demanding, as part of, based on the Sixth Amendment cross-section of the community requirement, that some convicted felons be on the veneer to sit on the jury in his murder trial. So that right was carried with it. Governor McAuliffe purported to not restore any gun rights, and his order said that he was not doing that. But there is a fairly complicated statutory regime that governs the restoration of gun rights, and there's a couple ways you can get there. One is through the governor, and he didn't give it to you. But if you've got your political rights restored, then you automatically have the right to go to a state court and ask the court to – you're eligible to ask the court to restore your gun rights. And that collateral consequence of his action did cause, you know, a bipartisan group of Virginia prosecutors, Commonwealth's attorneys, to put in an amicus brief supporting us, and, you know, included Democratic Commonwealth attorneys from, you know, very large Democratic jurisdictions, including Fairfax County and Loudoun County in Northern Virginia. And their concern was that they would be flooded with cases where convicted felons would say, I've been restored, judge, please give me my rights, and the prosecutors would have the responsibility of opposing them. So it did carry, you know, some collateral consequences with it, primarily in the area of sitting on juries and on gun rights.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending. You mentioned earlier about two New England states. They are Maine and Vermont, states from which even in prison you can cast a vote. Let's take another call now.
Dave Emerson with the Federal Society here in Berkeley. A couple of questions, and I apologize I joined the call late, so these may have already been covered. One question has to do with whether there's any bifurcation of the treatment of this if an election includes both state and federal members. For example, in this upcoming presidential election, is there an equal protection argument that's been made under at least the federal election separate from the state election that you're aware of? Has that been tested, or is it a matter of settled law? And then the other question I have is kind of disparate impact treatment has been, you know, becoming much more expansive in its application to a number of rights. It seems to be the trend. Are you aware of any disparate impact type of cases that have been brought, under this kind of equal protection argument?
Let me take the second one first, because I am aware of at least two, both brought in federal court and both raising, you know, straightforward disparate impact equal protection violations. One was a case that we defended on behalf of then-Governor Bush in Florida about 10 years ago. The 11th Circuit held that because the Florida felon disenfranchisement provision was enacted prior to the Civil War, it could not have been enacted with racially discriminatory intent, and so it did not violate the Equal Protection Clause. And a similar case was brought in the late 90s against the Commonwealth of Virginia and the Fourth Circuit, similar to the 11th Circuit, held that Virginia's disenfranchisement statute did not violate the Equal Protection Clause because it had not been enacted with discriminatory intent. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten your first question. Would you mind repeating it?
The first question had to do with just, you know, whether or not there's a whether state elections and federal elections are analyzed similarly for equal protection types of claims, or whether there's an argument to be made that even though a felon may be barred for voting in a state election, in a federal election, it may require a somewhat different analysis.
I don't think. Under current law, I don't think there's any distinction between state and federal elections. The Constitution, as you probably know, authorizes states to set the qualifications for electors in voters in federal elections, subject to revision by Congress. And Congress has not enacted anything related to you know, felon disenfranchisement. I believe Congress could require for federal elections, if it chose to, states to that persons convicted of felonies be permitted to vote. But Congress is not. But it could only do so in federal elections. It couldn't obviously require that of state elections. Under current law, I don't think there's any distinction. The one place where it came up in our case really had more to do with standing than anything else. We very much wanted to be able to bring a statewide action that covered all of the felons that the governor had re-enfranchised. And the only way to do that would be to identify injury to our voters that was statewide in scope, and we were essentially able to do that only because of the presidential election. All other things that are on the ballot, all other elections on the ballot are, you know, congressional districts. And so so a voter in Fairfax County in a congressional election is not injured by a convicted felon from Roanoke participating, but because and neither of our senators were up this year, but because the Virginia's electors, like those in, you know, all but Maine and Nebraska, are all chosen based entirely on the statewide election results, the injury on the presidential election flowed statewide. But in answer to your question, I really don't think there is any distinction on the merits of the issue between state and federal elections.
All right. Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. A final call for questions here. I believe we've had our final question. So let me, Michael Kirk, revert to you, give you a chance to wrap up or express a final thought before we end the call.
Well, I don't really have anything substantive to add, Dean. I do want to thank you for hosting this, and I want to thank all the questioners for their interesting question, and I want to thank you for having me.
Well, and I thank you for doing this. It's been a very interesting discussion, and I will join you in thanking the audience and remind the audience that our next scheduled Teleform conference calls tomorrow at noon Eastern Time at the same number. We'll be talking about the False Claims Act, but until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.